The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices.
And I'm Rachel Silva. This morning, our guest is Jim Corbett, Associate Director, Marine Policy, and Professor, University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment.
Welcome back to Campus Voices, Jim.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Professor Corbett's work focuses on technology, policy, and innovation for 21st century freight systems, with a focus on international shipping and coastal marine policy. And before joining academia, he was a merchant mariner himself.
So what's this quote from Joseph Conrad you've got at the end of your email signature file?
Joseph Conrad, who many people know wrote The Heart of Darkness, was a ship captain. And he was one of the ship captains working at the end of the age of sail and the beginning of the age of steam and motor. And in his memoirs, he lamented the fact that as ships became motorized, that they would no longer have to yield to the weather and humor nature. And I like it because it is a truism about global trade today and because it is an opportunity to remind ourselves about partnership with nature and the ocean environment and stewardship.
And that quote is?
Your modern ship, which is a steamship, makes her passage on other principles than yielding to weather and humoring the sea. The machinery, the steel, the fire, the steam have stepped in between the man and the sea. And here's the quote. A modern fleet of ships does not so much make use of the sea as exploit a highway.
Wow. The reason I went on at such length to have you go through that is I think it's fascinating. You've got this background as a merchant mariner, plus now a researcher.
I was reading some journals from back in the 1980s when I went to sea. I reread a reflection of mine where I talked about how wonderful and pristine the ocean environment was, but that if you sat on the stern of the ship, what you smelled was the gases, the sulfuric gases from the stack.
Why, that sets up the paper we're going to talk with you about.
Yeah. I'm aware that you just recently published a study in the journal Nature Communications about the effects of lower sulfur maritime fuel. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. First, directly with regard to the paper, our paper evaluated how cleaner and lower sulfur fuels for ships will reduce the health impacts to communities around the world, where fuels used today by ships are the residual or leftover products from refining. And as you might imagine, when you purify the petroleum fuels by distilling it, as you boil off and purify gasoline or diesel fuels, the materials that are contaminant, that are in the crude material, in the unrefined product, they get left over. They end up accumulating in this residual ship fuel. We found that if you remove some of these contaminants, namely sulfur, from these ship fuels, that we could reduce by half the number of childhood asthmas, and Wow. that we could reduce by about a third the number of premature deaths from exposure to the particulates, the particles formed by these sulfur products that come out of the stack when you burn the fuel.
And then people would breathe in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And these are problems that happen all over the globe, not just along coastal areas.
Well, sure. And in quite generally, these are problems that happen whenever we burn any fuel at all. We produce combustion products. And those combustion products include small particles and diesel engines, large engines that work on a compression ignition basis. tend to be very good at producing large numbers of small particles. So even a truck in the United States, or a train, fishing vessel, or your car, which is using an internal combustion engine, produces these small particles. What's unique is that when the fuel quality comes with all of these particle-making substances already, then you get more particles, and ships then become ideal technologies for producing very large numbers of a wide variety of particles. Those particles, if people breathe them, are always harmful when they get deep into the lung. And what we looked at is, what's the role of global shipping in adding particles to the air that people breathe along the coastlines or in communities where trade and transportation includes shipping?
These sulfur particles still get carried around the globe in the trade winds and so on and so forth.
When the engine produces power and burns the fuel, the leftover gases and particles come out the stack. The smallest of those particles will stay aloft in the atmosphere unless rain washes them out for between 10 and 30 days. And during that time, they can move around the world. So particles from ships that are reaching land from two big processes. The process of shipping operating on major trade lanes around every continent. So the shipping is rather close to where two-thirds of the people live when trade is being carried. So it's emitted in places that matter. And then secondly, once these particles enter the atmosphere, they can be moved around for between 10 days and a month, during which they may be blown onshore, into and over communities where the concentrations of pollution that they breathe are increased.
I think it's one of the fascinating things about paper that you and your colleagues have published is just the maps and the animated maps in there. I mean, just showing just even the trade routes that the ships follow, and then matching that up with how the sulfur moves through the atmosphere.
Yeah, the pattern of trade leaves fingerprints and footprints and smudges all throughout. The shipping carries water for stability so that the vessels won't tip over. And when they take on or discharge that ballast water, they can carry species everywhere. When they burn fuel, the exhaust material is left behind that individual ship, but then joined by the next set of ships that follows behind it within the next few days. And so you can get quite a large smudge print, footprint of air pollution along these shipping lanes.
And how did you decide to go about the research process?
I think you were talking about a three-step process that you went through.
There's two questions in that question. Is what motivated us to do this, and how did we do this? Let's start with the how. In order to do a health risk assessment, an assessment of how any industrial activity like shipping and transportation affects people, we need to understand what is the nature and volume of the material that's being released, or how much pollution is emitted by ship engines as they operate. So we have a state-of-the-art inventory of shipping activity, where ships operate around the world, and that's derived from satellite data that's downloaded. Every couple of minutes, or more frequently, ships are required to report their locations, their identity, and some other details that's important for the national security of maritime nations. And that data is sent, transmitted by all of these commercial ships. And if you collect that information across a number of transceivers, you end up with a global image of shipping activity. We use that, we match it up with the names of the vessels, with their installed power characteristics. We observe the reported speeds from the data that's sent by those ships. And then we end up assigning what the amount of energy they should be using and calculating how much emission should be released. So we have a very good picture. In the last 3 or 4 years, we've had the best, most resolved picture of where shipping emissions occur that's ever been produced. And we accessed this model of shipping emissions with colleagues and collaborators who work in the Finnish Meteorological Institute. Step two is then we need to know what happens during that 10 days or month of time when the gases and particles released by these ships are moved around and processed in the atmosphere. And for that, we use a set of global chemical transport models. They're a set of models that will look at what happens to the sulfur as it turns into sulfate particles, which are small acidic particles. It looks at how they interact with water and rain and meteorology and weather. And we are then able to get a sense of where downwind and with chemical mixing, where the remaining pollutants from ships add to the particle pollution from industrial power plants and factories and residential communities and all of our other activities, including automobile transportation. That step, by the way, is a pretty complex set of atmospheric science and chemistry. And for that, we relied on a system of models developed at very high resolution that also came from the Finnish Meteorological Institute. Step three was then to look at population data, where people were living around the world, and use a layer of population density maps overlaid by a layer of these pollutant particle concentration maps. Mm-hmm. And where particles are really intense, where the concentrations of pollutants are high, but there's no people, the impacts are rather small. And where people are very densely populated, but they don't become exposed to these particles, they also get very few impacts. So we looked at where the peak concentrations contributed by ships coincided with the peak population densities, again, at very high resolution. Unlike previous work where we use sort of big checker squares on top of each other to try to mm-hmm. get a sense of that, and you'd have some sort of average across this big checker square, we used smaller pixels like you might think of in a really good high-definition video screen. And we were able to overlay high-definition on high-definition, so we get a good example of where peak concentrations of air pollution from ships and peak population coincide. If the population are adults, then we employed a health risk equation to calculate the increased risk of early mortality from lung cancer or cardiovascular disease. If the population was largely youth, we looked at where the additional concentrations of ship pollution could be associated with increased risk of asthma cases.
Since my day job is in IT, Jim, I'm fascinated by what you just described. I mean, this sounds like, you know, you're using multiple layers in the GIS system here to take data sets that before would have been very difficult to compare.
Yes, it's an important and exciting type of work that we're able to do. And we're not in any way the only ones doing it, but this is interdisciplinary work where we need to have an understanding of the underlying motivation for shipping to move, which is really economic and socioeconomic. And then we have to understand the engineering technologies and combustion technologies by which pollution is produced. Then we have to understand atmospheric science and chemistry and the fundamentals of physics in order to understand where pollution goes and how it changes. And then we have to understand epidemiological and health research in order to understand and estimate what those impacts are.
We're speaking today with Professor Jim Corbett, who's an associate director of Marine Policy and the University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. And as fitting with that last response you gave, you also hold joint appointments in the College of Arts and Sciences and Public Policy and in the College of Engineering in civil and environmental engineering, I believe.
I think like many professors here at the University of Delaware, I'm a professor of being curious.
Going back to what you mentioned previously, you worked with a Finnish geological team. What was it like working with an international research team?
I appreciate the question, and I have to tell you the truth. It was very familiar. This is a terrific team, and along with a professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology and with an outstanding researcher who works in a consulting company, We had a key team of six or seven folks and co-authors, I think, of 9 or 11 people on the paper who have worked together multiple times to advance the integrated research tools that we needed to employ here. The first time that we worked very closely together was on a 2014 report for the International Maritime Organization, where we produced the most recent official inventory of greenhouse gases from global shipping. The other question you had asked relates to the motivation for this work. And one of the key motivating reasons to begin this work was presented to us in the spring of 2016, when we recognized that the International Maritime Organization was coming upon a decision, a policy review decision, where they were trying to decide whether to implement sulfur emissions reductions that we have now evaluated in this research paper, to whether to implement them in 2020 or whether to listen to the concerns of industry and refining, where it might be expensive and difficult, and delay that first ever significant reduction in sulfur emissions from ships for another 5 years. So we began to look at these health impacts in the spring of April 16, because we knew that without an understanding of the potential for these cleaner fuels to provide real quantifiable health benefits, then there was an opportunity for the industry to focus only on how many dollars it would take and how difficult they perceived it to be, and to argue for delay. We didn't finish this work at the quality that it is published in time for their decision, but we presented preliminary results, and the industry, through the International Maritime Organization, did hold the line and confirm its commitment to a 2020 change. At that point, our research transitioned into an evaluation of what that achievement would be with regard to health impacts. And so we worked together first on the climate change project, and then we've worked together for over 2 years on this work. And I look forward to collaborating with the Finnish Meteorological Institute and the other co-authors again and again.
I think what's fascinating about this research and about so much of the research you do, Jim, is that it's not a clear win-win-win-win all the way down the line. There are some negative side effects as a fact of going to cleaner fuel and your projections about global warming.
Right. So we're talking about how these sulfur particles are emitted in the lower atmosphere, where they can be transported over where people live. Whether or not they get transported over where people live, these small sulfur particles are able to reflect sunlight. And they can reflect sunlight more or less depending upon where we find them. As they reflect sunlight, they can either help create clouds, make current clouds brighter, or make clouds that are bright last longer. All of that has a reflecting effect on how energy coming into the Earth's atmosphere from the sun is trapped or reflected. And this additional reflecting energy has been seen as and quantified in terms of a small temporary cooling effect that has to be calculated along with the long-term greenhouse gas warming effects in order to understand what the net change in temperature or how climate change is going to be observable today and in the coming years. A way of thinking about this is to think about a pot on the stove at home, say an open pot with some water in it that isn't too warm and it isn't too cold, it's just being heated. And we think of the greenhouse gases as a long and sustained source of heat trapping. So for the stove analogy, you could think of it as the heat on the burner underneath that pot. That heat will change the temperature of the water in the pot over time, either quickly or slowly, depending upon how strong it is. These sulfate particles are reflecting. They are energy reflecting, and they have a slight cooling effect. So you could think of that as spraying a spray of water, cool water, on top of the open pot of water as it's heating. And if you keep spraying small particles, they just fall into the water and then they soon essentially disappear. They become just like the water. But if you keep adding them, then there's this small cooling effect that will slow the rate of change in the temperature in that little pot. These sulfate particles act a little bit like that. They don't undo the heat in the burner. They don't undo the greenhouse gas effects at all, but they dampen how fast those greenhouse gas effects might be observable as a temperature change or as a weather change or as an extreme set of energies in the atmosphere for extreme weather events. And what we studied is what happens when we remove these particles, not only in terms of how it relieves the burden of health and illness, but how it also reduces the net reflecting effect of these particles in the lower atmosphere. And that effect is important and needs to be considered as the world faces the challenge of reducing greenhouse gases.
Thinking how people's eyes glaze over with large numbers, and here, you know, you've got a finding that it's really, we do this, it's going to be great for people's health, but there's going to be a small side effect in terms of global warming. How the heck do you explain this to lay people or to policymakers so that they can make some sense out of it?
It's really important to recognize that since industrialization, we have been doing two things to our environment with combustion of fossil fuels. We have been adding long-lived greenhouse gases that will trap more and more energy, and we have human-influenced now, measurable and human-influenced trapping of energy in the atmosphere that we call climate change, some call global warming. We also produced a lot of particles and gases and materials that interacted in the lower atmosphere to directly harm people's health, to change the way that vistas could be seen. In some places in Southern California, you can't see the mountains for weeks at a time because of the haze of these small particles. Increased asthma, increased lung cancer, increased cardiovascular disease. We have been doing both of those simultaneously since industrialization, and only since the 1960s or so did we decide that the pollution side of the problem was something we had to do something about. What we've been doing for the last 50, almost 60 years now is addressing oxides of nitrogen, addressing oxides of sulfur, reducing the amount of particles that we emit from power plants, from cars, from homes, from fireplaces, from factories, from aircraft, from our trains. Every single thing that we use that has combustion involved contributes to both of those things. So as we've been addressing the environment for human health, for people living now, we had not been, and still maybe are not, well addressing what the effects will be on people living in 50 or 100 years, our grandchildren's futures. And we are now waking up to the idea that we need to do both. That is tough to explain to lay people. It's tough to explain to economists. It is difficult to explain to policymakers. And it is a difficult problem to decide about, because there will be people who will say that the future climate is more important than the asthma illnesses of children in coastlines in Africa today or in Indonesia today. And there will be other people that argue that we need to avoid disease today and bring more trade and more economic well-being to people today, and we shouldn't worry about greenhouse gases at all. And I would say that those two extreme perspectives need to be bridged.
I think it's really impressive that you very obviously care about the environment and want to make all this information known to the public. If you don't mind me asking, what made you decide to go into this field? What passions brought you to this?
As a policy analyst, as somebody who's interested in how policy decisions are made and how to help inform better policy decisions going forward, I would say I've been a curious listener to what in the policy debate stumps the policymakers for making decisions with regard to the environment, with regard to stewardship, with regard to technology. And when I hear one side say, we don't know if the harm caused by these particles is large enough, important enough, and severe enough to to be worth spending all of this effort to innovate and upgrade our fuel system and our vessel engine systems so that we reduce those effects. And the other side says, well, we don't really know either, but it matters and we have to do it no matter what it costs. There's the impasse. And the industry is pretty good at telling us what they think it will cost. And there needed to be some scientific help to inform both sides of what we thought the best estimates of the health impacts could be, so that they could decide, as good policymaking intends for them to decide, whether and how fast to address the burden of pollution with the economic and technology means at hand.
We've just got about a minute left, so what would you like our listeners to take away from our conversation?
This is what I think the listeners need to know in terms of this research and high-minded stuff and decisions that are made someplace far away about ocean ships that they will barely see when they drive past the Port of Wilmington. What we're talking about in terms of these health benefits will be millions of fewer cases of childhood asthma in places that have limited means to address their own pollution concerns from ships with their own government legislations. Places like Indonesia, the Panama Canal. Children and adults living in Panama do not control or interact even with the ships going through the canal, but they get impacted by the pollution left behind. So on the one hand, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of fewer premature deaths and millions of fewer asthma cases. So these are big benefits around the world. And what it means for the listeners is maybe an extra penny at most in the cost of your shoes when you go to the store. Those shoes are carried by ships. It may be an extra 2 cents for the next flat screen TV that you buy in order to pay for these cleaner fuels. And these cleaner fuels might add to your pound of bananas maybe 1/100th of a cent. So what we're talking about here is a very important and expensive measure to clean up fuels for a very important benefit in terms of health, and we will still have to address the greenhouse gas problem, and maybe with a little more intention because we'll be removing these particles from that process, and it'll come at a price that most of us would be willing to pay if we thought about our role in global trade and environmental stewardship.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jim Corbett, Associate Director of Marine Policy at the University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, and a not-so-ancient mariner.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM. WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at WVUD.org.